Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does life change after a president leaves the White House? After John Kennedy's inauguration in 1961, President Dwight D. Eisenhower and his wife climbed into their 1955 Chrysler Imperial and drove north to the family farm in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. From there, he monitored the progress of the burgeoning civil rights movement, mentored the career of Richard Nixon, and settled into private life as a sort of third parent to his grandchildren. The Eisenhowers' only grandson, the beloved namesake of Camp David, was 12 at the time. He spent the next 8 years of his life forming a close and influential bond with the man America knew both as war hero and commander-in-chief. David Eisenhower is director of the Institute for Public Service at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book, written with his wife, Julie Nixon Eisenhower, is called Going Home to Glory, a memoir of life with Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961 to 1969. He's in town to speak this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. David, welcome to Think.
Chris, thank you. That was a great summary of the book. That's exactly what how it opens. The Eisenhowers were leaving the White House and leaving Washington. So many books open with the transition to John Kennedy that day, but this one opens with the trip home.
What I like about that is that it's a sort of quiet, very real moment, and then you describe the fact that you had been up on the dais with your grandfather, you'd been on planes with him, you had never seen him before as just a member of the crowd.
Chris, good point. This happens early in the book. I find myself attending a Welcome Home Ike ceremony in downtown Gettysburg on the night of January 21st, 1961. It's 14 degrees or so outside. It is cold. And I'm a member of the audience for the first time. I'm not on a dais. I'm not part of a motorcade. I'm in the audience, and I'm standing there close to friends, and I'm watching my friends perform for my grandfather. And I can see it in my mind's eye yet. I can see the way the floodlights were sort of playing off his bare head, and I remember how cold and inky everything was, but what great cheer he exuded and how enthusiastic the Gettysburgians were to welcome him home. And at several points in Going Home to Glory, I stand back and appreciate him from a distance. I do this again in Europe. I see him in several settings and so forth, and gradually I come to understand who he really was, and I think I got to understand who he really was in a very deep way, because not only did I come to appreciate his stature as a former president and general, but I also came to know him as a grandfather, an ally, and in the closing sections of the book as kind of a friend and companion.
Talk a little bit about braiding together what you knew of him as a human being with the – you've done other books about him. You did a book about Eisenhower at War in the late 80s, and then you're studying from an academic perspective. I wonder, though, were you also searching even in that project for glimpses of him before you knew him, before you were born?
Well, what I did was I took the person I knew to the records of World War II to do Eisenhower at War, and I felt that because I knew him – in ways that I probably could not articulate at that time, but I recognized when Eisenhower's mad in the papers, or I recognized when he was delighted by something, so forth. I felt I could bring some sort of interpretive angle to the war record. I was really examining an area of his life which to me was a mystery, and also I understood it to be important in our family. It's something that I grew up curious about. My grandfather did not talk about his war past. My father, who shared that with my grandfather, did not talk about it much either. I was not prohibited from learning about World War II. It was not exactly a forbidden subject, but I was not part of it. And so one of the very first things I did, I think in writing, and you've had many guests on your show who are writers, in the final analysis, what drives a book forward is a desire to know or share a special knowledge. You write about things you either know about or want to know about. And I wanted to know about this war story. I devoted years to Eisenhower at War, 1943-45. And in the course of it, actually, this many years ago, I drafted this book. And I went back to it about a year ago at the encouragement of my editor, Simon & Schuster. I was happy to be pushed in that direction because this is a story that I very much wanted to share. But I actually drafted it, or at least parts of it, as I was drafting the war story to remind myself of who this figure was and the person I knew.
What was it like to dive back into this and read the observations you had made when you were, I guess, in your early 30s at
right.
the time?
Well, what I did was Julie helped me a great deal, my wife, and I made a decision very early, and that is I was going to tell this story as I told it to myself privately in my early 30s. Not long after my grandfather had passed away. I wanted to preserve that voice. And so this is written through the eyes of somebody who has recently experienced Dwight Eisenhower, and on the basis of interviews that I had had shortly after he died. And because what I realized is that I cannot recapture the feelings that I could see on paper in cold print. I could never recapture that today, certainly not in a vernacular that would give it true expression. And so I preserve that. And then what I've seen, of course, in all the decades since, and I teach in politics and so forth, and I've written lots of articles and, of course, the war book and so forth, I understand the story better than I did when I initially took a pass at it, and so I was able to enlarge on it. But I'm very careful to preserve the voice of a 30-year-old.
Ending an 8-year term as president has to be an extraordinary relief and also an extraordinary letdown.
Yes, yes.
Did you sense any of that when you were a teenager in him?
Chris, that's very well put. You know, the 22nd Amendment, which we have as part of our Constitution, the term limits presidents, really imposes an unnatural limit on very charismatic and able people. They are obliged by law to step down from a position that I think a lot of people would have a hard time giving up for understandable reasons. They have been in the center of events. They are reluctant to hand control over things that they want to get done over to a successor.
Especially a successor from the opposing party.
Opposing party. My grandfather experienced all of that, and the beauty of this story, and I could really appreciate this, particularly when I went back to it last summer, is that he was a human being. He experienced his moments. His impulse was to strike out and make waves, to remain president to some degree, but he had the grace to ease this transition. To do the right thing, and then to accept it as a human being. What happens in going home to glory is that I'm growing up and he's growing old.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book opens. He's a he had been president only hours before. And by late winter and early spring, he's a general again. And then he spiritually moves back in time. He becomes somebody who remembered his trips to Europe with Mamie in the interwar period, and when they worked on the Pershing staff in Paris, and then he becomes a West Point cadet again, and then he becomes a boy in Abilene, and he moves back, and he's accepting very much this this new life, and he made the best of it.
Let's talk about being a general again, because it's typical for former presidents to be addressed as president for the rest of their lives, and,
right.
and I think most of them enjoy it very much. Dwight D. Eisenhower specifically requested that President Kennedy restore his 5-star rank and preferred to be addressed as General Eisenhower.
Well, this is a request that Dwight Eisenhower made of John Kennedy about a month and a half after leaving office. In fact, this was a bill that was around, is in a committee, or it was somewhere while Eisenhower was still president in the closing days of his presidency. The request was to accelerate passage of the bill so that Eisenhower could reassume the rank of Army of the General or General of the Army. This is a request that puzzled Kennedy. I tell the story through the eyes of Ted Clifton, who was John Kennedy's military aide, and I put it out there. And I must admit, I sort of scratched my head a little bit, too. I'm not sure. Kennedy was surprised. Why does Why does Ike want to be known as general? Former president ranks general, at least John Kennedy saw it that way, and I think Dwight Eisenhower did too. What my father's explanation, and I quote him, is that the rank of general, as his father told him, I worked all my life for it. So he valued general. I think that there had to be more to it. I think that what Dwight Eisenhower is probably saying symbolically, and presidents are conscious of their legacy, maybe not as president. As president, you are governing, but when you leave the presidency and you're looking at years out of office, that is when you are going to be thinking of legacy. And I think that Dwight Eisenhower's view was, I'm imagining this, if you want to understand his times, if you want to understand his decades in national and international service, begin with the events of June 1944. The bond between the command and the soldier of World War II is the transcendent bond of his public life. And symbolically, he says that by taking the title general even as he leaves the presidency. I think what he's saying about his presidency is that the presidency is an extension of the Great Crusade in Europe. It is an extension. It is winning the peace after having won the war. And in my mind, what I took from that in my own career is that to understand Dwight Eisenhower, to really understand him, I had to understand his experience in the European theater and in North Africa and in Italy. I had to go back to 1941, 42, and 43 and fill in all of these things that I sort of understood instinctively, but had never really had an opportunity to talk to him about, or not given the chance to talk to him about.
How political were the conversations around the dinner table?
Not that political, surprisingly. This is a, I think one of the things that a reader will see in Going Home to Glory is that Dwight Eisenhower was somebody who separated work and home. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of very, very distinguished guests. In fact, a look through the guest book at the Gettysburg Farm is really dazzling. And I remember most of the people who were there, and I remembered looking through this guest book just how rarefied that atmosphere was. There were always distinguished visitors on hand. But
could you appreciate that at the time, or did it seem like regular life?
I appreciated some of them. I spent an evening with Winston Churchill. I spent an afternoon with Nikita Khrushchev, who was Premier of the Soviet Union, Harold Macmillan, who was British Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, who was Prime Minister of India. People like this, when they were around, always sort of thrilled me. I knew that I was meeting somebody special, and I wanted to make a make an impression. But I think the people that I missed slightly are the well, you take a figure like Admiral Strauss. Admiral Strauss, who was chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, is somebody who made history in this country in the late 40s and early 1950s. He created the nuclear industry in this country. He's a person with an extraordinary life and background, highly influential in American history. And I think I missed that somewhat as a teenager. I knew he was important. I knew that he and my grandfather were very close. But I missed that about him. And, well, as I say, politics was not every day. What's happening is that Dwight Eisenhower is becoming, he's becoming a farmer. And he's becoming a grandfather in this period.
David Eisenhower is my guest. He's director of the Institute for Public Service at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book, written with Julie Nixon Eisenhower, is called Going Home to Glory, a memoir of life with Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961 to 1969. He's in town to speak this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Eisenhower, author of Going Home to Glory, a memoir of life with Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961 to 1969. He'll be speaking this evening to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth at the Rosewood Crescent Hotel in Dallas. Tomorrow, he's got a luncheon event at the Fort Worth Club in Fort Worth. You can learn more about both those appearances at dfwworld.org. You mentioned that your grandfather was becoming a farmer during this time. This was no vanity project that he moved to. This was a working farm.
It was a working farm, and I think also sort of a quest. The Eisenhowers, every American family has got their own story of how they arrived in this country and how they traversed it to where they live now. And the Eisenhowers were from the Rhine Palatinate, which is a western part of Germany. They escaped that region during the religious wars of the 17th century. And they made their way to America and landed near Wilmington, Delaware, and Philadelphia, and worked their way westward. But the longest period of time they spent anywhere was really in the central Pennsylvania near the Susquehanna. And set that aside. They closed that homestead down and moved west, and things did not work out for them in the West. And watching the passion that my grandfather invested and poured into that farm, I just feel that he's reclaiming a homestead in a way. This was something that he wanted to do again, and this time make something permanent. One reason why the farm, I think, is in the hands of the National Park Service now and is a national monument is that Dwight Eisenhower wanted to assure that it would perpetually be farmed and that it would be perpetually kept, maintained in the way it's being maintained today. The farmlands are leased. It's a productive farm today, and this is exactly the way he would have wanted it.
Is it bittersweet, David, that the buildings where you spent so many nights and ran around are not in private family hands anymore?
Chris, yes. Of course it is. It's bittersweet. But in fact, doing Going Home to Glory reminded me of those years, and it reminded me of the pros and cons of surrendering up this property. I was also using a document that my father gave me about 2 years ago. It's a diary that nobody knows about. Or nobody knew about until this book came out, written in the 66-67 period. And one of the little features of it is that my grandfather is narrating the steps taken to hand the farm over and how he's feeling. And what I understood reading these entries is that this was meant to be. This is how that property, which we love dearly, this is how it is maintained forever. The character will never change, and we're actually fortunate to have it that way. We had a reunion at the farm about 2 years ago. The people who were butlers in the White House during the 1950s and other people who had known and worked for Ike and Mamie Eisenhower all came up to the farm for a day-long picnic. The National Park Service was great. They welcomed it. We had the most beautiful day you can imagine, and what's beautiful about it is that it has not changed. The farm that I describe, which is really an idyllic place, is still there.
I have to tell you, given the scope of the book and the importance of the subject, this might seem like a trivial point, but I really love the sections where you write about your grandparents' television viewing habits. Because, first of all, they remind me so much of my own grandparents,
right.
But suddenly they're real people mm-hmm. who have these important lives and have done these important things, but they're just regular people. Can you talk a little bit about watching TV with Ike and Mamie?
Well, I found myself a number of times, this is age 15 and 16, I found myself spending evenings with them. In the summer of 1964, my family had moved away from Gettysburg. My father took a job in the greater Philadelphia area. And I was in prep school at the time, and I just didn't feel like starting over with new friends. And so I got a job in Gettysburg and lived with them all summer. And so there are these evenings that you're talking about that I recreate. I recreated them the way I knew how. It's there's Mamie sitting at her table playing solitaire. And there's Granddad sitting close to the TV, and I'm seated in the middle, literally in the middle. And he's got this gadget that he can't operate very well, and so he's punching these buttons, and the TV is going through all the various channels. And
this is like the earliest remote control.
Yeah, earliest remote control. And then suddenly I become sort of stakeholder. They start arguing, or they start discussing what they want to see. Mamie has her tastes. Ike has her tastes. His tastes. And so they sort of serve it up to me. And I just thought back on those evenings, and they were fun. There are scenes or pictures that I have of my grandparents that I really cherish. They bring a smile. And one of them is these two wonderful people sitting on the sun porch and going through the television dial and trying to decide what to watch.
And he liked musicals.
Yes, he did. He was very sentimental in a lot of ways. He had strong tastes, as my grandmother did as well. Somebody who is has worked that intensely, somebody who's been a president or somebody who's been a general and so forth, has to be pretty good at relaxing. And so he had very strong taste in reading. He had strong taste in movies. He would not abide a movie that he did not want to watch. He had certain movies that he did want to watch, and in fact watched over and over again. One of the movies that I talk about in Going Home to Glory, it was his favorite, and that was Angels in the Outfield, starring Melvin Douglas, or not Douglas, and a 1951 fable produced about the Pittsburgh Pirates, who were losing until angels intervene on behalf of a irascible manager who is now going to be brought to the light, and angels begin assisting the Pirates, and they start this sort of Cinderella drive for the pennant. My grandfather loved that movie. According to Sergeant Mone, who was his valet, I think Sergeant Mone ran it, he said 38 times. I think the number is a slight exaggeration, but that's the number he used with me. I saw it with my granddad at least 8 times, 8 to 10. And so he had sentimental tastes, that says something about him. He's somebody who believed that many of the things that he and his generation had experienced were profoundly tragic, and that there is a nice, soft, sweet side of human nature that he wished that he had seen more of. And so he sort of lived this in movies.
The way you describe him here, he had just this profound commitment to doing what was right, to trying to take the central path within his own party, at least.
Yes.
Which is something that we all sort of lament the fact that seems to be absent across the political spectrum today. Can you talk a little bit about the risks he was willing to take to do things that really matter to him?
Well, he had great stature coming out of World War II. Not very many national political figures that we've had have enjoyed the kind of situation that creates. And so he resolved, after World War II, to comporting himself in a certain sort of way and using his influence in the most constructive way he could devise. One of the things that he became certain of is that America needed a political change in 1952, that the Democrats, in dominating the White House as they had during the Roosevelt and Truman years, though Dwight Eisenhower had served these presidents and valued them, he felt that our democracy required an effective opposition. Mm-hmm. Dwight Eisenhower was also a Republican. This causes him to make a very statesmanlike a decision in 1952 to sacrifice a good deal of his personal popularity for the sake of accomplishing something that he felt was vital, and that was putting the Republican Party back in business in the post-war era as a genuine opposition party. That was a far-reaching decision. And as president, and then as former president, I think he approached things the same way. He was not somebody that enjoyed political combat particularly. Not for its own sake. He was practically retirement age when he got into politics. Mm-hmm. And he had a very strong sense that there is a very constructive thing perhaps that I can accomplish here by, first of all, becoming president and a Republican president, putting the Republican Party back in business, and second, trying to guide the future of the Republican Party in a constructive way. And then third, and this is something that stems from World War II, and I think one of the reasons he may have taken the title general, being available for leaders in both parties who wanted to avail themselves of his experience and his insights, and so he freely gave of them.
And that included the civil rights movement that he was very much in support of.
He was. Let me put it this way. I think that Dwight Eisenhower's strategy and his approach to civil rights probably developed exactly as the civil rights movement did. When he was president in the late 50s, I think the one thing that Dwight Eisenhower understood about himself as a general, he was not a the kind of person who was going to be an effective advocate for civil rights. But as president, what he could do was lay the foundations for necessary steps to bring about what one of his biographers calls simple justice in the area of civil rights in the early 1960s. So what the Eisenhower administration does is they concentrate on enforcement of court decrees, of appointing a court, courts at all levels that will that is willing to step up to this issue, and conditioning the American people for the great changes that John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson carried forward in the 1960s. These are the two great civil rights presidents, Lyndon Johnson particularly, who was a friend of my grandfather's, a very close friend, and somebody that I cover, talk about at length in the book. I think that Dwight Eisenhower, as he watched the Kennedy bill being submitted, he watched Lyndon Johnson pass this bill in 1964 and then a Voting Rights Act in 1965. I think my grandfather looked on it rather wistfully. I think that he wished at some level that he had been president and with the power to do what these presidents were able to do. You know, what sticks in my mind is Lyndon Johnson's speech to a joint session of Congress in March of 1965, where he said, you know, he talks biographically, autobiographically, speaks of the poverty he had seen in rural Texas and so forth, and he says at one point, "I never dreamed in my life that I would have the power to make this world better. Mm-hmm. But now that I have the power, I'm going to let you in on a secret. I'm going to use it." And I think that Dwight Eisenhower as a president might have liked to have
said the same words.
Yeah, to have said the same words, but he contributed, I think, in an important way to the civil rights gains made in the early 1960s. And I was around when this was happening, and it was a daily reality. It was something that we were conscious of, dinner at the farm and evenings on the sun porch and so forth, and so I made a record of it.
It had to have been a great blow, David, that Richard Nixon did not win the White House. Can you talk about the relationship that Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon had?
Well, they had a... It's a wonderful question, Chris. In fact, there's a book underway right now by another author, which is going to focus exclusively on the Eisenhower-Nixon relationship. The thing that Nixon and Eisenhower are usually evaluated as superior and subordinate. People wonder whether Ike, the boss, approved and whether Nixon, the subordinate, felt appreciated. And this is the way people look at this relationship. Actually, standing now all these decades since, and I knew them both very, very well, I see it in a slightly different, I see it in a much different light. I see Dwight Eisenhower, a twice-elected United States president, dealing with Richard Nixon, a twice-elected United States president. And to become elected president of the United States, you're quite a person to begin with. It's amazing to me that given the strength of temperament that is required to be a leader of that stature, that these two people got along as well as they did. And it's interesting to me that they saw each other sort of in this boss, subordinate mode, and that they felt any emotions about it at all. And they did. They felt emotions for each other. It's very similar to a relationship that my grandfather had earlier in his life, which is somewhat beyond the scope of this book, and that was with Douglas MacArthur. My grandfather worked for Douglas MacArthur, I believe, for 7 or 8 years, maybe even longer, in Washington and in the Philippines. And Dwight Eisenhower thought of himself as a subordinate, and he wanted to be appreciated by General MacArthur. He wanted MacArthur to praise the speeches that he wrote for him. He wanted to and he did. The evaluations that MacArthur wrote about Eisenhower still exist, and they're quite something to see. But then one day, MacArthur pushed him out, literally pushed him out.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1938. And I see intelligence. I see a design here. I think that MacArthur understood that Eisenhower was a command personality and not a staff personality,
yeah.
And that he had to let him go. And my grandfather didn't understand it. In fact, his diaries are sad on this point. I will never give the general the satisfaction of knowing that I am done, and so forth. And but he was being cast out to take on the roles that he was really suited for. And so they wind up being European and Southern Pacific theater commanders and five-star generals, both. Eisenhower and Nixon are figures of they're very important political figures, and they don't interact that way. They interact as superior subordinate, and that means that the story is slightly artificial. What I saw was genuine warmth, and I did see that. And that was something that it was not automatic. There were a lot of feelings about 1960. I encountered this when I was dating Julie. But in the final analysis, I was impressed by things that they had in common.
My guest this hour is David Eisenhower. He is director of the Institute for Public Service at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Going Home to Glory, a memoir of life with Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961 to 1969. He is in town for events this evening and tomorrow with the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. David Eisenhower is my guest. His new book, written with Julie Nixon Eisenhower, is called Going Home to Glory, a memoir of life with Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961 to 1969. Let's go to the phones now, and we will speak with Anthony in Arlington. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
On the show. I just had a quick comment. I wanted to bring up a quote from Eisenhower. As I've seen on YouTube, and kind of controversial, but that's always somewhat of a good thing. He talked about, and I'm quoting him here, he said, be wary of the military-industrial complex, and I think that kind of reaches down into a real modern sense, even in his past times talking about that, kind of bleeds into what I believe he felt, and I hate to speculate about his views. But.
Well, you're breaking up a little, Anthony, but we've got it. The famous farewell speech.
Sure. In fact, this is delivered 72 hours before Going Home to Glory starts. It is delivered on the night of January 17th, 1961. It is probably the most important farewell speech given by a president. And one of the...
Certainly the most quoted.
Most quoted, and I think considered to be one of the top 10 speeches given by an American in the 20th century. Interestingly, given 72 hours before John Kennedy gives his inaugural, which is also considered ranked even higher.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very important question. What did Dwight Eisenhower mean in warning the nation against the unwarranted acquisition of influence by a military-industrial complex? And I would say one thing about the speech is that it is timeless. It is not a prescription for the future. It is timeless. And if you look at the that particular warning and look at it in context, what Dwight Eisenhower is really doing, and we see him doing this in the pages of Going Home to Glory, is that he's meditating on the great riddle of the 20th century. The riddle of the 20th century is astonishing technological progress and growth on one hand, accompanied by disasters and tragedies on the scale of World War I, the Depression, World War II. We're talking mid-century. And the question he asks in this speech is the question that his leadership generation faced constantly, and that is, how can this be? And how can a democratic people prevent the tragedy and embrace the future? And his analysis of why Europe had been destroyed in World War II and World War I and so forth, his analysis and of how these totalitarian regimes had become established is that free people had ceased to be citizens. To guard against the unwarranted acquisition of a military-industrial complex is also accompanied with other warnings, a technological scientific elite, against anybody who would make decisions for you. His notion of citizenship is that you take charge of your life, you take responsibility for your life, and you make your decisions. You make your own decisions. If people collectively surrender decision-making up to authority, they cease to be, we cease to be a free society. And so it's a call, really, it's an analysis. It's a reflection on his 50 years of service. It is, in the final analysis, a call on Americans to be citizens, to be unafraid of requiring people who pose as experts, people who operate from a distance, requiring them to explain themselves in terms that make sense to us. The Pentagon works for us, not the other way around. Scientific laboratories that turn out products in the final analysis have to serve our needs, and don't be afraid to insist upon that. That's the point of the speech, I think. And it's backward-looking, and it's reflective, but it's also timeless. And Kennedy's speech is also timeless, but very forward-looking because he's becoming president. And these two speeches, which sort of stand back-to-back in January 1961, identify that month as one of the great speech-giving months in all of American history.
So most people probably know that Julie Nixon eventually became your wife, Julie
right.
Nixon Eisenhower. The family loved her. Obviously, there were family connections, but it wasn't easy for you to tell your grandfather
that you
were getting married.
No, well, he was an imposing man. And as I say, I present a lot of our correspondence, the letters he wrote me. And looking back over those letters, I want to take time out when I have grandchildren. To care about them as much as he cared about my sisters and I, me. He had four grandchildren, and my correspondence with him was tremendous. But that being given that, he was still a very imposing figure. And
scary?
Somewhat. I cared what he thought very much, and he was also the kind of figure that made you think twice. He was an incredibly dynamic individual. Well, be that as it may, he did not want me to get married young. And
you were 20.
He was 20, and he meets Julie, and he likes her, but he begins cautioning me against doing anything rash. And then suddenly, I've decided to do something rash, and I've got to put this to him. And I talk about Thanksgiving 1967. When we have dinner downstairs, and then I'm invited to his bedroom where he's going to take a nap, and I'm given an opportunity to tell him what my intentions are. I'm actually seated next to his bed, and we sit in silence for about 15 minutes, and I choked. I could not.
Did he already know at that point?
Yes, I'm almost certain he did. In fact, pretty sure the diary that I referred to earlier in the show tipped his hand there. Two things happened after that. First, he sent me a letter essentially saying that he regretted that we had not found a way to sort of level with each other there. And he would try to improve that in the future.
It's an extraordinary letter for a man of his generation.
It's an unbelievable letter. And he wrote that letter, one like it, to my father. And he wrote, I'm aware of at least one other that he sent to an associate, professional associate, earlier in his life. It's something that I will always treasure. The other thing, and this is how Going Home to Glory closes, is that he gets to know Julie, and he gets to see us together. And at the close, as he's a dying man at Walter Reed, he's keeping a little diary. And in these diary comments, he leaves no doubt that he is glad that Julie is part of the family. And he's crediting me with having made a very wise decision, which I feel I did. And so we all live happily ever after in a strange way. I mean, this is we all came together and had a meeting of the minds on this, and that was one of the wonderful things for me to see. And I'm glad that he got to know her as well as he did. He considered her a extraordinary person. He just told everyone within earshot that he felt that way, and it's reflected in his writings.
Your grandfather lived to see Richard Nixon elected president in 1968. He did not live to see the disgrace that followed.
Right.
Was that something that was a source of relief to your family, that he didn't have to suffer through that?
That's a very interesting question, Chris, and I've never heard it quite put that way. How he would have responded, whether it would have happened, is a question mark. In fact, I quote Bryce Harlow, who was one of my grandfather's longtime associates, an Army associate as well as a White House associate. And he's saying he was imagining if Dwight Eisenhower had lived. And he said, perhaps Nixon would have avoided a lot of the trouble if Eisenhower had been around, because Eisenhower would have been active. On the other hand, Nixon might not have accomplished as much as he did in a extraordinary first term, 1969 through 1973, as he did. That's ending the war in Vietnam, undertaking. There is a boldness in Nixon. There is a habit of boldness, which accounts for great breakthroughs between 69 and 1973, great strategies. America's losing the war in Vietnam when he takes office, and we emerge from the Vietnam War with a solid strategic partnership with the Chinese, with a détente with the Soviet Union, a peace with honor, and the foundations for the 80s, when America emerges as victor in the Cold War. This is a miracle. It required bold thinking. And this bold thinking was a habit of mine that carried over into everything that Nixon did, unfortunately. And so he boldly confronts all of his critics. There's a running war with the anti-war movement. By 71 and 72, relations with the Congress are in terrible shape. The stage is set for a disaster. Now, I think that Eisenhower might have had a restraining or an inhibiting influence, but for better or for worse, who knows? The Nixon story is such an extraordinary one. And it's also one that plays out without a whole lot of former presidents around as well. Lyndon Johnson and Harry Truman both died in January of 1973, just before the Watergate storm broke. Watergate, among other things, is a passage in American history in which there are no living former presidents to either condemn what happened or to provide solace or to provide any perspective. It was Nixon alone entirely.
Having been so very close to two presidents and knowing them as human beings probably to a greater extent than you knew them even as leaders, do you come to criticism or praise of any president with a different perspective?
Well, I have a way I look at presidents. First of all, I begin by recognizing how extraordinary presidents are. That is something that I will say about any president. And they are extraordinary people. That is something that I've appreciated even more and more as I go through life. Where these people come from and what they accomplish, it's our system. The American system, the beauty of it, is that we require presidents to run the marathon, to undergo this trial by ordeal to become president. And that means that the people who rise to the top of our system are very able. And I understand that about them. The other thing I understand about presidents is that they're mission-oriented. And the presidency is a mission-oriented job. It's a leadership job. It's a mission-oriented job. And the way I evaluate presidents, and I think real success and failure, is understanding what the overriding issue is at a given time that a president is elected or placed in office to address, and how that is done and at what cost. I'll give you a good example of a presidency, and one of my favorite non-family member presidents is George Herbert Walker Bush of Houston, Texas. I think he was a complete success as a president going into 1992. Success almost to a fault. Mission accomplished. Mission accomplished will leave a presidency adrift or vulnerable at a certain moment.
Because we're asking now what, you think?
We're asking now what. Now, what becomes politically relevant the moment a presidency has succeeded is not expressing gratitude for what a president has done, but identifying the next issue in the next team that's going to take that issue on. And this is a process in which the president has a voice, but often a futile one. The George Herbert Walker Bush accomplishment in 1991 in organizing the Gulf Coalition is one of the great miracles in American history. His management at the end of the Cold War is a masterpiece. He was somebody who had been trained in government and grew up with a great government ethic. He's a remarkable president and a very successful one, but politically, that did not mean re-election in 1992. That's one of the great ironies in recent history.
Do you also feel a particular affinity for all presidential offspring? Seems like there's a great deal of pressure on those kids.
There is pressure, and I'm a member of an entity, an advisory commission that meets with the National Archivist to coordinate presidential foundation matters. I've gotten to know a lot of them. People we've known, and here we are in Texas. The Johnson sisters, Lucy and Linda, are wonderful people. They have always been sort of the center of this network, and they have become friends. We're really proud to say they've become friends, very, very good friends. In fact, Linda was one of the best friends we had in 1973 and 1974. Linda and her husband Chuck during Watergate were tremendous to us. These are people that understand each other. And what has happened through this advisory commission is that they've actually come to understand each other. Yeah, and so they've all become friends, and that's the way it ought to be.
David Eisenhower's new book, written with his wife Julie Nixon Eisenhower, is Going Home to Glory, a memoir of life with Dwight D. Eisenhower, 1961 through 1969. He's in town for events tonight and tomorrow with the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. David, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Chris, thanks for everything. I've really enjoyed being on The Thing.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.